So I want to shift a little bit into some of the big ideas that you have written, the big ideas to stand with rural America. You include healthcare for we the people, confronting climate change, level the agriculture playing field, and ending eminent domain for private gain. Before we get into eminent domain, what came up for me was that these are environmental justice issues. Your thoughts?
Absolutely. And, you know, in rural America, you don't think of protecting the land and water, you know, conserving land for wildlife. A lot of times that's not seen in an environmental justice lens. It's seen in a conservation as being good stewards of the land. So the language is very different, I think, between rural and urban on this particular kind of environmental piece. But there is a significant amount of environmental justice. And really looking into the next 20 years, our country is going to be building a massive amount of clean energy. And the environmentalists and kind of big clean energy corporations have not reckoned with this basic fact. We are going to have to build a lot of this clean energy in rural communities where we have not talked about environmental justice. We have not talked significantly about climate change. There's a lot of misinformation about wind, as we saw with Donald Trump saying on stage that wind is going to cause cancer. So there's a lot of fear around the development of clean energy. So we have a huge task ahead of us to really, when it comes to environmental justice, to really make sure that when we're about to develop a whole bunch of clean energy that's going to take a whole bunch of land, including transmission lines, land for transmission lines, we're going to have to spend a lot of time working hand in hand with the community. And they really should be at the table. We shouldn't treat the communities like the railroad companies did hundreds and hundreds of years ago, or how big oil did over 100 years ago and still do today, or fracking companies. We need to treat communities where they should be deciding where the big wind farm and transmission lines are going to be. They should be at the table also being part of the wealth creation that is going to come out of a clean energy boom. That is something that I keep on flagging for environmental groups as well as the Democratic Party, because it's coming, and it's coming quicker than we realize it. And if we don't start to realize this, we're going to see what we're already seeing in a lot of our rural towns, where they're zoning out wind and zoning out solar because they don't want to be taken advantage of from their perspective.
Literally, the landscape in western Colorado, especially in the Roaring Fork Valley and resort areas, because the Roaring Fork Valley is a resort area, as you may know. There are several ski areas here. There's one outside of Glenwood, which is a small ski area. And then we've got Aspen at the other end, Aspen and Snowmass at the other end, which are some of the biggest ski areas in the world, most famous anyway. And so, you know, the issues are changing here, and you know, there's a huge population influx. And it's not just because it's a resort area. It's a lot of people believe that it's a COVID-19 issue, where people have been, you know, moving out of cities and realizing they can work remotely, and so they're moving to beautiful areas and raising prices. So there's a housing crunch, there's a land use shift, and you know, I guess I'm curious as to how you propose to address these different issues in these desert and resort communities where rural means something different.
This is why county commissioners are such a powerful position, and mayors of small towns, because they really are the ones in the end that are responsible for zoning and for making decisions on, you know, are we going to rezone this agricultural land to now be a residential community, et cetera. We're now looking at the next 100 years of America. And I do think when Joe Biden talked about the next bill that he has, you know, the American Jobs Act, where we are talking about building out the infrastructure for the next 100 years, our cities and our small towns are beginning to transform. We have to make sure that the people who have lived, you know, for generations in these communities, that culture and identity is not lost. Or what you begin to see is what I think Austin experienced, where Austin was kind of a smaller town, you know, more, you know, funky neighborhoods. And then a lot of people started flocking there and really is now obviously this major metropolitan city with a lot of folks who originally lived there feeling very left out. And
so this is Austin, Texas. You're talking about Austin, Texas. Okay.
Yep. And you could even argue that that's, you know, what happened in Denver as well. And how do you balance the growth that we all want to see for our state and for our towns with responsible growth, where people are at the table creating wealth, not just big developers creating wealth? So this is going to take a tremendous amount of planning and zoning and really being a lot more creative. A town in Mexico just unveiled, and they spent years, you know, studying this, where they decided they were not going to do roads and strip malls in this one community, that they were going to go back really kind of, you know, to the days of, you know, brick-lined roads where smaller shops, smaller houses, smaller apartment buildings, so people really got to know their neighbors, and rather than creating big suburbs. So I think suburbs will obviously continue to exist, but we should also be looking at different models for our cities, so it's not becoming essentially corporate owned, where none of us know our neighbors and none of us have a sense of identity attached to our community anymore.
You mentioned the importance of county commissioners, and I want to bring in eminent domain here a little bit. That seems to me to be a huge issue for you, is eminent domain, because of what was happening on the Keystone XL. Can you talk briefly about what that is? What is eminent domain, and why you're so fierce about it?
You know, over 100 years ago, eminent domain was first used in our country, mostly, you know, around railroads and when oil pipeline and kind of transmission lines were first getting developed. It's a policy that the government put in place to say, and for roads, you know, and like highways, that if landowners could not come to negotiation with the federal or state government, that the government had the right to take that land and pay, of course, the landowner fair market value, so a project essentially couldn't be blocked by one landowner. It was supposed to only be used for public purposes. Then a decision came in 2005 at the Supreme Court. It was called Kelo. It was a Kelo decision that essentially was the opening of the door to say private corporations can use eminent domain for their private gain. So no longer was it just our government can come in and tell somebody we're taking this land for a road, that for public purpose, et cetera. It could now be used for private purposes. In particular, big oil and big gas have used this, but so have, you know, big arenas. Donald Trump is known for using eminent domain for his casinos, and it is a major problem. I think, one, because so many communities and individuals, families, and traditions are tied to the land, this is not just for agricultural communities. This is for, you know, Black communities down in Memphis that are facing eminent domain challenges, or kind of in Western Colorado, in New Mexico, along the border, families, ranches were literally split in half because of this particular thing of building the border wall. You know, communities and ranches were split in half. So I just think, you know, I'm a big fan of saying no eminent domain at all. And I know that a lot of my progressive allies think that that is not a realistic approach to take. But I truly believe, especially for private gain, that it should be banned at the federal level. And right now it is very piecemeal. You know, some states don't allow eminent domain to be used for private gain, but the vast majority of states have carve-outs for big oil and big gas or other kind of, you know, private development issues like big arenas. So this is something that I really believe in, because I believe that this is one of those perfect examples of the little guy getting beaten by big corporations and big government. And I don't like it. And I think that our country was founded on the belief that individuals have a responsibility to the community. And I don't think that the government or private corporation should be able to come in and tell us as individuals or a community what we should or should not be doing with our land.
Unfortunately, I can't tell you if Garfield County is an eminent domain county or not. But I do know that the Garfield County Board of Commissioners have an image of being champions for property rights. However, they really pushed the Jordan Cove project. And for listeners who may not be familiar with the Jordan Cove project, that It's now pretty much dead in the water, no pun intended, but it's a Canadian venture. The Canadian company wanted to build this huge natural gas liquefaction plant at Coos Bay, Oregon, and then this giant Pacific Connector pipeline that would have gone from the southeastern corner of Oregon all the way up to Coos Bay. And eminent domain was a huge part of that. And that's what got a lot of the property owners along the pipeline route involved in this fight. But Garfield County commissioners were champions of Jordan Cove because it would have taken fracked gas out of western Colorado and exported it to wherever, Asian countries, whatever. And I found that strange because they're such champions of property rights, and eminent domain just has, there's no respect for property rights. Your thoughts?
100%. It is one of the most frustrating hypocritical stances that I've seen from local elected officials as well as federal and state elected officials. For example, our governor, Pete Ricketts, and a lot of the Republican governors are now out there telling a whole bunch of lies about President Biden's 30 by 30 plan, which essentially is a goal to have 30% of the land in conservation by 2030. And this is no different than what Pheasants Forever or groups like Ducks Unlimited, all conservative groups that many Republicans are part of the leadership of, are also pushing for, to make sure that wildlife is protected and our wetlands are protected. And obviously, this has an impact on climate change. And so they're out there saying that they are advocating for property rights and being against the 30 by 30 plan, even though that's a voluntary program and eminent domain is not going to be used. But yet those same people all supported pipeline development and pipelines using eminent domain against landowners. So, you know, I do think us as citizens and us as voters really have to keep these politicians in check on this issue. If you're for property rights, you have to be for property rights. You can't say you're for property rights when it's against wind and solar. Then you're perfectly fine with eminent domain taking land for a pipeline or for fracking. It's essentially the same thing. And if we are serious about protecting property rights and making sure that when you own land, obviously as long as you're not polluting on that land, that you get to decide, you know, the future use of that land. And when we are talking about reimagining some of our small towns and what it's going to look like when we have to build out massive amounts of clean energy, we should not have eminent domain in the mix. We should be really going into communities, and it's obviously going to take a lot more time and a lot more money, but in the long run will be better for the community and for the land if we're engaging landowners up front, saying, do you want wind and solar on your land? Where is the best place for the transmission lines? I mean, folks listening know this. You know your community better than any outsider will know. You know when we get a lot of rain, where those flood areas are. A lot of time outsiders don't. They look at a map and look at what's the shortest distance from A to B so they can get their products to the export market.
How do you explain the land rights and property rights issues to tribal nations that you've worked with?
When we first started working with tribes, I was very nervous about, for the obvious reasons of a lot of our farmers and ranchers were living on land that was in the hands of the Winnebago, the Omaha, and the Ponca. And the obvious, really negative feelings that could be between both of those communities. Instead of using anger, they both saw each other as allies, and Native Americans really looking to the farmers and ranchers and saying, you now understand what we went through and what we continue to go through. So I really am a champion of tribes' sovereign rights and that they are sovereign governments within the United States. And, you know, there were several tribes in South Dakota, for example, that really claimed their sovereign rights and blocked roads to when Standing Rock was becoming a big issue in South Dakota, North Dakota. So I think there's a lot of common ground there. I think the tribes are going to be clear leaders when it comes to more sustainable agriculture, the growing of hemp, medical marijuana, and clean energy. Those are all areas that they see as real economic growth areas, as jobs, not only for their tribal members, but that won't really hurt the land. That will kind of put nutrients back into the land while also developing their sovereignty and their economic growth.
In your book, Harvest the Vote, you mention Senators John Tester, the late Senator Paul Wellstone, and now Interior Secretary Deb Haaland as politicians you admire. What do they have in common besides being Democrats?
All three of them, Wellstone, Tester, and Haaland, have in common that they always fight for the little guy. You know, that they're the ones on the floor of the Senate or the House, and now Secretary Haaland inside the Department of Interior, who's saying at the table when decisions are being made, how is this going to impact small family farmers and ranchers? How is this going to impact tribes? How is this going to impact families? And none of them have fear that if they push for a policy that may mean less money for big corporations, none of them had, you know, for obviously Wellstone's no longer with us, but none of them had the fear that it would hurt them in the next election. All three of them had this common trait that they were going to fight for what is right, and they were going to communicate that to the voters, and they believed that that would earn them more votes, not less. And all three of them were right. And, you know, John Tester in particular, in a very kind of Republican state, but continues to win statewide because he always fights for the people and then communicates that, right? He doesn't just hope that people know that. He goes back to his small rural communities across Montana and really makes sure that people know what he's fighting for and really stands his ground. That's what all three of them have in common, that they really are that definition of America, of we the people, that for me, they are the perfect definition of that.
Jane Klebb, what is your message for Western Colorado, Garfield County?
You know, one of my big messages is that we have to stop looking at the R or the D behind people's names and really start asking ourselves, is this politician who's asking for my vote the kind of most trusted thing that we can give to an individual? Are they going to do right by our community and by our families? And not only on the three kind of hot button issues, right? Whether that's guns, abortion, you know, whatever the hot button issue may be, but is this person actually going to fight for us and not fight for big corporations? That's what I hope Western Colorado really starts to look at in 2022. And maybe that means you're voting for Republicans and Democrats. Maybe it's only Democrats, right? But really letting go of a partisan label and really starting to look at maybe this Democrat doesn't have, you know, horns and a tail. All of the issues that they have on their website and that they talk about in the town halls, I really do agree with. So it's okay for us to cross those party lines in order to do right by our communities.
Are you planning on running for office?
I'm not. I think that my kind of skills and passion and love is in organizing and is in kind of structural party reform. You know, I just was on a party reform committee that created the next level of funding and where funds are going to go from the DNC to states. And part of that was this, you know, thing that I've been pushing and I talk about in my book of a red state fund, giving more resources to red states, not less, even though on the surface you would think that that's not strategic for Democrats to do. But if we're going to grow and we're going to compete, our red states and our red communities need more resources, not less. So that's where I think my skills are best suited. You know, I'll be in the streets and in kind of the rooms pushing for party reform and hopefully doing a really good job recruiting and training candidates so they can win.
Well, Jane Klebb, author, organizer, and chair of the Nebraska Democratic Party, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me.
It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed visiting with you.